The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning, my name is Vic McCunis, and you have just entered the Book Nook. The best of the Book Nook, that is. And I go through the archives now and then and dust off a cassette tape. And it's kind of like opening the phone book to a random page. I look at the name on the tape and I think, I do not remember who this person is or what this interview was about. But I know this has been a buried treasure just waiting for me to pull it out and for us to digitize it. And I did exactly that. I pulled out an interview that was recorded back in 2002. If you were listening last Sunday, you might have heard my interview with Kathleen Rooney for her children's book. And we used to cover a lot of children's books on the program. And back in 2002, we covered one written for middle schoolers by a writer named Karen Cushman. And I saw her name on the tape when I pulled this cassette out of the box, and I thought, Karen Cushman, I don't remember who that is. Well, to refresh my memory, I listened and I thought, what a lovely interview. Let's listen now to Karen Cushman, recorded back in 2002, talking about her book, Matilda Bone. We call it the best of the Book Nook. Karen, tell us about yourself. How did you get into writing?
Well, people ask me how long it took me to write my first book, and I tell them 50 years. Because I wrote a lot when I was a child, but stopped, went to college, had a lot of different kinds of jobs, and just before I turned 50, I woke up one morning. I had been thinking about children and lives of children long ago and differences between now and then, and I woke up with this idea for a story in my head about a girl who was at odds with her family and her time and her place, who wanted things they couldn't give her, and who didn't want to give what they wanted. And I wondered what life would have been like for her. She wouldn't have had many options. Children didn't have a lot of power or value, especially girl children. So I wondered what she would have, and I thought about it for a while. And I said to my husband, I have this great idea for a book. And he said, you've been saying things like that for 25 years now, and I've never seen a word on paper. He said, this time I won't listen to your idea, but I'll read it if you'll write it down. So he gave me paper and pencil, and I wrote down sort of a quick outline of what the story would be about. And once I had it on paper, I felt a sort of commitment to it. I wanted to know what happened to this girl and these people, and so I began writing what turned into a book after a lot of research and hard work, and that was the beginning of a whole new life for me at 50. So I have been writing now for about 10 years. I was able to quit my real job and to just write and talk and travel and think, and it's been wonderful.
Was that Catherine Called Birdie?
That was the first book,
And that is set in what time period?
It's set in the year 1290 in medieval England. And Catherine is the daughter of a landed gentry. Her father is a knight and owns a manor. And Catherine spends a lot of her time avoiding doing embroidery and all of the other things that the daughter of the household should be doing, and looking out the window wishing she were a villager and climbing trees or fishing in the pond. And the book is written as a diary. I thought it would help us get to know this girl from a different time and place even better if we could see her through her eyes as well as through our own eyes. So I set it as a diary. It's a year in her life. It was a lot of fun to write. I think it was an interesting story that I wanted to tell, but also there was no pressure. I didn't even know if it was going to turn into a book at that point. There were no editors, publishers, critics, readers, teachers, librarians, anybody looking over my shoulder as I wrote. I kind of just wrote it for me. So that was the very beginning.
So you had a lot of freedom.
I did. I had a lot of freedom.
My guest is Karen Cushman. This new book, Matilda Bone, I'm guessing this takes place in approximately that same period. Are you fascinated with this period of history?
I am. I am fascinated with the Middle Ages. I don't know why exactly. I have spent over the years time listening to medieval music and going to medieval and Renaissance fairs, and I thought that the time period was colorful and interesting enough so that I'd want to spend some time with it, that it was close enough to us so that I felt like I could begin to understand these people, but it was still different enough to be kind of exotic and different. And so for a lot of reasons, I got involved in it. And then after I researched the first book, I felt like I knew it so well that I had a number of stories I could tell from that time and place. So the second book I wrote, The Midwife's Apprentice, was also set approximately in that time period, although the hero of that one is a homeless child, a girl who, when the book opens, is sleeping on a dung heap for warmth. So her life and her circumstances are very different from Catherine's.
Well, clearly these first two books attracted some attention. I understand you won the Newbery for that second book.
They did. The first book, Catherine called Bertie was an honor book, a Newbery honor book, and then The Midwife's Apprentice won the Newbery Medal, which was, quite a life-changing experience.
That is a big deal. Tell our listeners what the Newbery Medal represents.
Well, it's given each year to what they call the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children. And each year, one book wins the medal, and 0 to 5 books maybe are named runners-up or honor books. So it is quite a big deal. I think it's very prestigious. But it also means that the book is going to get into a lot of hands, that there are libraries who will buy the Newbery winners, schools who will maybe require the Newbery winners. So it isn't just chance that your book might get into the hands of readers if it wins a Newbery Medal. And I think that's really important, that the more people who can read it and who write me letters telling me how much they like the book.
You were totally unknown. As you said on that first book, you were writing just for yourself. Suddenly you've got two books out. The first one's a Newbery honor book. The second one wins the Newbery. Suddenly you're a known person, and I'm guessing that second book also took place in the Middle Ages. The third book, The Ballad of Lucy Whipple, you decided to go to the 1840s for that one.
Yes, I fully intended to write another medieval book, but I was looking at some books on history in a bookstore, and ran across one on the California Gold Rush, and a blue blurb on the back cover said, "The Gold Rush was a movement of men that fully 90% of the people who came to California to search for gold were men." Then it went on and on about those men, and I thought, wait a minute, that's dismissing 10% of what was a sizable population. Those women and children who came to California, who were they? Why did they come? Did they choose to, or were they dragged across the country? Did they stay here, or did they go home? What did they find when they got here? And so I started out researching and got very involved with the story of Lucy Whipple, which in many ways was my own story, because when I was 10, we moved from Chicago to California because of my parents' dream to go to California, and Lucy in the book is dragged all unwilling across the country to California Gold Rush town because of her mother's dream. So I was able really to understand Lucy Whipple and get involved in her story.
My guest is Karen Cushman. Her new book is Matilda Bone. On the cover, we have a young woman, a young girl, and she's standing there with a basket, and she looks sort of befuddled, and there's an eel in the basket.
There sure is.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that a wonderful cover?
I love it.
Trina Short Hyman, the children's book illustrator, has done all of the covers for the hardback books, and Random House has chosen to use her original cover for the book on the paperback, which I think is wonderful. And on the back cover are all of the townspeople that poor befuddled Matilda meets when she moves from where she had been raised, which was at a manor house. Her parents were dead, and she was raised there by a priest and learned a lot of Latin and French and church history. She knew all about saints and devils and heaven and hell, but nothing about the real world. And due to circumstances, she winds up in the medical quarter of a medieval town, where she is really a fish out of water, like that eel, I guess. What they think is important, she doesn't. What she thinks is important, they dismiss often as foolish. And she really has to learn what living and blood and guts are all about, as opposed to the otherworldly things that she had always been interested in.
I love the way you get into the head of this 14-year-old girl, and at the same time you give us this amazing history lesson.
I had a wonderful time with the medieval medicine. I'd really like to revisit it sometime and do more, because it was a fascinating world.
The book was quite different originally, wasn't it?
Yes, well, it went through a number of changes. At first, I told the story, each chapter from somebody else's point of view, talking about Matilda, which was a lot of fun to do, but turned out not to tell us enough about Matilda, but told us more than we needed to know about all these other people who were talking.
Mm-hmm.
That's something else I'd like to revisit. I think that would be quite a challenge. I've read several books that are set in that format. But I found it, with a character especially as prickly and as difficult to get to know as Matilda, I found it too difficult to do in that fashion.
So you let her tell the story.
So I let her tell the story.
This woman that she moves in with, the bone setter.
Uh-huh.
You can tell when you first meet her that the reader is going to fall in love with her, but Matilda isn't so sure.
Right. Matilda has been raised to think that people like Peg are not very worthy, and comes in with all of her attitudes and her superiority and her sureness, and finds everything tumbled upside down. I had a wonderful time with Peg. I thought she was a great character. When I started the book, I thought about making her a blood letter or a dentist, some other kind of medieval a medical practitioner, until I ran across a reference to such things as bone setters, who were almost like early chiropractors. And I thought that would be a wonderful metaphor for this woman who winds up adjusting Matilda's attitudes, sort of the way she does other people's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I went with her as a bone setter. But all of the different medical fields are so different to those of us here in the 21st century, and we can look at them as superstition or foolishness, you know. And then I thought, what's going to happen in another 500 years? You know, will the medical practitioners of the 26th century look back and say, oh, you know, heart transplants, how barbaric, or dialysis, what kind of torture was this? You know, just the way we do with our superior medical knowledge of the 21st century. So it was very interesting to think about.
I think that's a pretty safe bet, Karen.
Yeah.
Here I am, probably a little bit older than your typical reader, and I really enjoyed this book and learned a lot from it. including the fact that at this time in history, women were allowed to practice medicine, and then something happened.
Yes. I think that, as I recall from my reading, what happened was that as the medical profession got more professional and more organized, the men began to take over. And once they began to take over, they started to push women out. And at first they were pushed to the periphery, like they could still be midwives, or they could still be bone setters, or they could still do some of the attendant activities around medicine, but they could no longer be physicians. And then even that disappeared, and women were really regulated out of the medical profession for a lot of years, until the 19th century, really. And then women had to fight to get back in. That it was not easy for the first women pioneer physicians.
And in a way, that women were written out of history at that point, kind of like they were during the Gold Rush.
That's right. Yeah, I think that when women are needed in the general population, like during World War II or during the Crusades, when the men were off in the Holy Land and women were running the manors or the businesses, that we were allowed to have much more power than we were able to keep when uh-huh. men came back and it was business as usual. I think that that's a general theme that runs through history. And it's a lot of fun for me, as well as I think valuable, to go back and look at these sort of lost and forgotten women and what they were doing, because they were there all along. We just haven't heard about them.
Back to the kitchen, dear.
That's right.
My guest is Karen Cushman. The book is Matilda Bone. You mentioned that you hear a lot of things from your readers. Who are your readers? Who are you hearing from?
I hear a lot from, I'd say 6th to 8th grade, mostly girls, but a lot of boys who are reading the books in class. I imagine that many teachers assign their students to write letters to an author. So those are the great bulk of the letters that I get. The ones that really please me and touch me are those from kids from second grade through high school who have come across the book on their own for recreational reading and are moved or touched or inspired by something in the books to write me a letter and tell me about it. Those are my favorite letters.
Mm.
I've even gotten some from adults who found something that really made them laugh in Catherine Called Birdie, or could relate to Lucy's unwillingness to move in Lucy Whipple. Those are pretty special, too.
Karen, what were you doing before you became a writer?
Just previously, I was teaching for 11 years in a graduate program in museum studies. In this area, we offered a master's degree for people who wanted to work in museums. And the last couple of years, I worked with students who were writing their master's theses. And I think that that had a lot to do with my moving into writing on my own, because I worked with students who had to take something from a vague idea to a finished product, something that they could write about and bind between covers. I had to help them organize and edit, make sense of a lot of material, move from a beginning to an end. And I think all of that practice, even though it wasn't for me, was working with these other students, really helped me when it came time for me to write something. When this idea for a story came into my head, I felt like I had been practicing with those tools for a number of years.
What struck me about the book Matilda Bone was that you deal with real things. Here we have this young woman who is growing up, and your readers obviously are growing up as well in this modern time, but with a lot of the same kinds of ideas in their mm-hmm. in their heads, and you're dealing with real things. People die in mm-hmm. your book.
Yeah.
You have a strange man, a physician, who collects bottles of urine. These are real people.
Mm-hmm. I think that we forget that when we read history books, that even George Washington in his white wig and wooden teeth with the little axe in his hand, you know, that we have these images and stereotypes and pictures, and they weren't like that at all. They were real people who had often similar issues to ours. I think people have always struggled for survival and have wanted to live rather than die, and have wanted somebody to love. As Alice in The Midwife's Apprentice puts it, a name, a full belly, and a place in the world. That's what we all want. And that throughout history there have been these real people, and it's fascinating for me to search out those things that make them real, that bring people to life, some kinds of quirks or ideas or values that are unique to them, but also very familiar to us, so that we really believe in these people.
And we learn about human nature. We have the fish seller who talks the naive girl into buying a rotten fish, takes advantage of her.
Yep.
We have the older lady who has the cat that she loves so much, and the cat has a broken leg, and the bone setter fixes it, and then they haggle about the price,
right.
And that's very sweet, and we get that sense of love for one another among some of these people, and I think it's a great mirror for a young person to look into and say, oh, wow, these people are just like me.
Yes, in many ways, they're very similar to us, but I think it's important to remember the differences also, that there were people believed very different things and thought other different things were important. In Catherine Colberti, there are people who are going out to a public execution for fun. This is a form of entertainment, to bring your picnic lunch, you know, your ale and sausages, and watch a parade of criminals being hanged. The Midwife's Apprentice, people ask me, well, why didn't anybody take care of this homeless child, or Edward, the other homeless boy? And there were no expectations at that time that every child would have a home or would be taken care of. That what people believed and thought important and valuable and true was often very different. And I think those things bring people to life, just as much as the similarities. So it's an interesting combination.
And there was that powerful belief that somehow letting blood was a good thing.
Yes. Well, and that persisted for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands maybe. I don't know how early that started, but I know in the 19th century, physicians were still letting blood to make people stronger, which is just the most, to us, bizarre activity that you can think of.
And you have fun with this man who's a professional bleeder. I love the scene where he has his leeches and they go and they visit this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's a laundress.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so cute the way you have the leeches, that they get very full. And he's very affectionate towards them.
Yes, he names them. I thought this man, if he was really that involved with his leeches, he'd make sure they all had names. He'd understand their personalities.
That was very sweet. What are you working on these days, Karen? Are you working on another book?
I'm working on a book about a girl who goes on an orphan train. Now, the orphan trains were these trains that ran from the middle of the 19th century till the end of the 1920s that were set up to take orphans or abandoned children from big city slums to the West or the South or somewhere else to find them new homes. Because they ran so long till, as I said, the end of the 1920s, there were actually people still alive who were orphan train riders.
Oh, my.
And had this experience. There's an Orphan Train Riders Heritage Association. I think that's what it's called. And they have a lot of information on the web, a lot of interviews with children or adults who were children. They do a lot of work in trying to help these adults find the families that they lost a long time ago when they were taken on the train and sent somewhere else. So they do a lot of genealogical research and helping to put families back together. But when I first heard about this, I thought of the terrible experience it would be for a child to stand on the stage at a school or on the platform at a railway station while all of these strangers walked by looking at her, thinking, you know, are these people going to take me home? Is somebody going to want me? Is nobody going to want me? What are they going to be like? Should I go? Should I not go? What does this mean to me? You know.
That's how they did it?
Well, some of the places would arrange the adoptions. They usually didn't result in adoption. They were a little less formal than that. But some of the places would arrange it in advance, so a family would come and pick up a child that had been earmarked for them, had a label hanging from her little jacket. But a lot of places took the kids and paraded them up and down the stage in a school or a church, and everybody in the community who would be interested in taking a child would come and try and find a match there.
What a compelling backdrop.
Yeah.
Are you going to follow a particular young person?
Yes, I've got a Polish girl from Chicago. And I thought that was very interesting when I decided to do that, because most of the trains left from New York or points more east than Chicago, and most of the riders were Anglo-Saxon Christian, that there weren't a lot of heavily ethnic children because they didn't feel like they could place them successfully out in Nebraska. But I'm a Polish girl from Chicago, and when I thought of this, I thought, that's who she is. So once again, I'm starring in one of my books.
That's great.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting to research and very powerful to think of this experience for her.
Well, we really appreciate you spending some time with us here on the program today.
It's been my pleasure.
And that was the best of the book, Nook, going back to 2002, my only interview with Karen Cushman for her young adult novel, Matilda Bone. And that was recorded back in the day when Dayton was very much on the book publicity circuit. She was in Oakland, California, and I spoke to her on the telephone, and she was getting ready to come out here and hit that circuit, going to Dayton and Cincinnati. And we used to get them coming through here all the time. I miss those days, but we still have access to so many authors. We talk to them on the telephone. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to dust off those old interviews and listen to them. And I remember looking at that tape and saying to myself, I don't remember this interview. I wonder what this is all about. And there you have it, Karen Cushman talking about Matilda Bone. She won the Newbery Prize, which is a big deal for a writer, and a very distinguished writer. And she's still active as far as I can tell. I Googled her. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. We have almost 1,200 podcasts available at wyso.org. You can listen to the Book Nook anytime you please. Have a great rest of your weekend.